Today is the day to wake, work, and win. Welcome to The Standard. So what's going on, fellas? It's been a few weeks since we chatted, and we were on a fire truck last time we chatted.
Well, we just thought you guys wanted to set the effect by wearing bunker gear, and that your set included looking like a rig.
I wasn't sure if they just put it on like they were in the firehouse, but then I heard like other people walking around, and there was like radio chatter. I was like,
but in a mall.
Maybe you have something more important to deal with right now than talking to us.
It's all just props. Yeah. Just paid for the props.
They were cool.
Yeah, we got a $1 million ladder truck outside. And anytime we want to have a business meeting, we go in there.
It worked. You got us.
We're like, oh, these guys are the real deal.
Yeah, but not really. We just have all the fun toys.
So I kind of want to get right into it. It's in the fire service right now, and this is I think this is not something that it's just our department. I mean, I think it's going on. Any department across the nation right now is dealing with this. Cops are doing less because they're being forced. I mean, political pressure, everything's just different these days, and rightfully so. You get it. I mean, there's just a lot of things that now they become liable for, and I wouldn't want to be a cop myself. But a lot of their things that they used to clear for us, say patients we run on or houses we go into, now we're showing up by ourselves, and we don't have what they have. We don't have weapons. We don't have bulletproof vests. Like we don't have any of that. But you guys maybe can give all of us firefighters some tools to deal with that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say first thing to those cops that are doing less, get out of the profession. There's a bunch of people that want to do a great job, that want the training, that will come in and do what you're afraid to do. You know, just because the tide swings a little bit one way or the other, you took an oath. So step up to the plate and do your job.
Well,
doing is creating a ripple that needlessly impacts you guys too.
Yeah, I can see that. I also do see the other side. I mean,
well,
personally, on our department, I mean, we got two guys that are starting a trial here pretty soon for, criminally being charged for something. And that's the first time it's ever happened in the history.
And so I took it as more meaning too, is like they're not sending police to certain calls, or they're taking different measures.
I feel like the cops in our city, like when the real stuff hits, they're still there. But there are those domestic violence calls that can be the most dangerous calls we actually end up going on, which seem very benign to start, but those can turn bad fast. And
totally agree. You know what? One of the just a basic problem before we dig into what you can do, the prosecuting attorney, you know, the mayor, all the people that are in charge, they're the ones that regulate when a cop, gets charged criminally, or a fireman for something, Title 42, Section 1983 U.S. Code, or negligence, or whatever else that they did. So the problem exists within the political infrastructure. And if coppers are doing bad stuff, because sometimes coppers are undertrained or make mistakes, but a mistake is not a crime, so we should draw the distinction there. What I get upset at is that there's always been tension between firefighters and coppers. And even when I was growing up, it was like wonderful watching you guys have the cookouts and do the weight gyms and stuff while we were in the run and gun battle. So there was always that, that joke, that professional thing. And then the idea is that everybody comes together like Velcro when there's an incident, and that's the way that it's got to be. But more and more, you're becoming targets in a situation. Like, I can't think of often that firemen become targets, but then all of a sudden somebody's getting evicted from their property, and firemen are on scene and paramedics are on scene as first responders to assist the coppers, and they take, sniper fire. There's ambushes. There's, people coming out of a medical condition with, fentanyl or drugs, and like the new Narcan, they're coming up swinging or fighting, or the fireman or the paramedic didn't do a search because they're not trained to, and the person comes up with a gun or knife. Those are the things that we think that you can address immediately without going in and shaking up the prosecutor's office and, you know, going to in Colorado, going to Governor Polis and go, what are you guys thinking, you know, prosecuting coppers and ruining some parts of the profession when they don't need that additional scrutiny.
Yeah, I 100% agree with what you're saying is, you know, it's kind of a political game. I mean, I think yes. I could speak for Craig on this too. Like, it's a political game being played right now. And unfortunately, it's, you know, we're in the crosshairs. And
exactly.
You know, so navigating that, I mean, that's the other part of it. So, you know, we have a great relationship with our police department, but right. that's getting strained because of all this, like, outside influences coming in. But beyond that, okay, now we need to engage more because, and that might be hands-on just for protection. But the problem with that is now are we going to be held criminally liable? You know, so
exactly.
And now you're thinking about what you have to do, right? Instead of it being instinct, you're thinking about it. And those couple seconds could mean lives.
More importantly, you have the sword of Damocles hanging over your shoulder when you're doing your job. You don't have the time. You don't have the bandwidth. The idea is that signal to noise is just a wasted time because it's a political antic and it comes up every year just before elections. And then we talk about mill levies and all those things. Listen, when I call 911, I need you on the spot, clear-headed, with the best equipment possible and the best support system. And the question is to the public, am I getting that? And now, as in other times in our history, we're not.
I agree with that. Yep.
So kind of before we get ourselves into these situations, what would you suggest we do as like first responders? I mean, honestly, I think anyone at this point should be thinking, how can I become more situationally aware? And, and you know, what things should I be looking for? But I think in our profession, we have an opportunity to train to become more situationally aware and kind of live a bit more in the yellow when we're going on these calls. So how do you suggest that we do that?
Well, I would start off right off the bat is kind of, you know, you got some things working for you that also work against you. And right off, you know, one, you're a firefighter, paramedic, your job is, you know, someone becomes overwhelmed in the situation, you're there to help. I mean, that's it, right? Which is different. That's part of law enforcement's job, but they're also there to deal with really, really bad people and crime. And that's not your focus. So you're coming in automatically going, how can I help the situation? You're looking for some sort of medical issue or safety issue, and you're not really taking into account automatically your safety. Now, I know you guys train for that, especially firefighters and paramedic, like scene safety first, and you can and can't do certain things based on the situation. But what I see is you kind of often overlook the big picture of, wait, what's really going on in here, because you're who you are. You're there to help and you want to rush in there and we want to get something done and we want to save a life. And that's what you're there for. And kind of what Greg alluded to is you're showing up somewhere, like you said, a domestic violence situation, which is always one of the most volatile situations anywhere in the world. Domestic violence, one, it can go to back down to them hugging and crying and I love you and everything's okay to a triple homicide interstate killing spree in nanoseconds. And I know that's kind of hard for a lot of people to understand it just because of how emotional they are. But again, you know, you're coming in and now you're actually a visible sign of authority. So if I've got three warrants out for me and I'm doing some bad stuff and you guys are there to help someone out and you come around a corner and I see a uniform and a badge, look, that's close enough. Uh-oh, here's the police. And that's when the killing starts or the shooting starts. And the idea is you're just there on it could be an unrelated call. It could be for some other reason. And now you are that. So you're part of a city in terms of, one, you're part of the structure and the everything that comes with being part of the city, whether you're some sort of city worker, cop, fireman, sanitation, whatever it is, you're part of the state, so to speak. You're a visible sign of authority. And so if I want to lash out, I don't need it to be against the person that did me harm. It can be, oh, that's close enough. Oh, you're here to enforce the code on my mowing my lawn because my grass is overgrown. You know what? F you, dude, not today. So, you know, you literally can, those events we see spiral out of control all the time. So there's a couple things that you have to consider in there. And one is that kind of mindset of what your role is in the situation. But what you just said was perfect. All right, we got to increase our situational awareness. You said, you know, you referenced Cooper's color code and said, stay in the yellow. Well, what does that mean and how do I do that?
And that's where a lot of people kind of get a little convoluted. They look for certain things that aren't always going to be there. And so we kind of keep it into general buckets. And I know, Greg, I know you kind of want to jump in there, but I did just want to frame it at least as to why some of the issues are different from your perspective versus a law enforcement perspective, but also from, let's say I'm that criminal, I'm that bad guy, and you're showing up on scene. Dude, I don't care if you don't have a gun. I don't care if that, if you look close enough to what I think a police officer is coming to arrest me, guess what? Now you're going to take the brunt of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think we used to be the good guys and we had this like shield of like, oh, I can walk into any house because I have my bunker gear on. But now, especially in the town that we work in, we have guys that are going to go to trial for murder. And so it's like we no longer have that. And so right. Now it's trying to still maintain a sense of like, hey, we're here to help. And I know that police are too, but they're also there to, you know, do their job, which is a bit more, can be a little bit more hands-on than ours is. But yeah. We also want to have a stance of, you know, we're not going to be victims here.
Yeah, you got to take a look at it like a continuum. And I would say measure it like the stock market. There's ups, there's downs, there's good and evil. In a long game, you're going to come back out on top because nobody wants a fireman there till there's a fire. Nobody wants a paramedic till there's a choking baby. And nobody wants a cop till they called them. And then when you show up, they want their agenda, not yours. Oh, that's the law? Well, let's petition the Supreme Court with redress because I don't think that fits my version of the future. So we've had eggs in our face. We've had black eyes. We've done really good things and we've done bad things. And what happens is the media doesn't sell, advertisement with good news. So the idea is we got to find a criminal and a common enemy. And that's exactly what they're doing now. So I feel bad for your friends that are getting charged in homicide. Love to take a look at that caper because I love the law. But the idea is the pendulum is going to swing back. And I don't mean swing back for, you know, thugs that are ramming cars and booting doors and doing bad stuff. I'm talking about for the people that are there to protect you for the long haul. So I would suggest to answer your question. First thing I got to do is see who the stakeholders are in the community and go and meet with them. And I'll give you a very brief example. Brian and I were at a private school down in let's call it Texas. And when we went to the private school, they spent a lot of money on their security and their safety and all of these second and third order effects. And I asked them, where would the helo land? Where's the level one trauma center from here? What's a backup route to get there if you couldn't? If a vehicle comes through the balustrades and hits this part of the building, you know, what is your exit strategy? Because this was your primary exit. And they couldn't answer any of that stuff. You know, they were great at the bake sales and the uniforms for all the cheerleaders. But when it came down to the brass tacks, and then they pointed and they held up a thing like a cross to Nosferatu and said, well, this is our emergency action plan. It's only as good as the gosh damn binding and the paper it's written on. So you got to go to your emergency room. First person I talk to is a security guard. What's your job? What are you looking out for? Are you trained in, you know, human behavior pattern recognition analysis? Do you understand situation awareness? Can you cue us in when we need to switch to an alternate emergency room because your triage is backing things up? You know, what's your blood storage capacity? What's this? All those questions that you guys need to know. Then go to the coppers. Hey, if we get a barricaded gunman, what's the plan? If one of the firefighters gets shot, what's the plan? If we have a dead cop on the ground and we're not moving in to take him because we're under direct fire, what's our backup plan? Nobody does it. We can't continue to make money on fear. And there's only a certain amount of technical equipment that is going to make your job easier. At the end of every day, at the bottom line, it's human-to-human connection, meeting those people in the community and building those stakeholders, rebuilding the trust every two decades or whenever it gets to that low. Does that make sense, Craig?
Yeah, but how can we, like, what are some nuts and bolts strategies that us as first responders can use that our next shift or our next, you know, and obviously this is a process that takes a while, but because to be honest with you, I think we do a really good job because we've had obviously the mass shooting at the theater. And I think we've had a bit more trauma in our city. And the great part about our department and the people that work for us is that they've had some real military experience that they've brought back. And so I think we have a lot of really good reactionary plans in place. But before it gets there, what are some things that we can do to, when I'm about to go in this house, kind of what should I be looking for? Or how do you guys teach that?
Great question. part of what we do is a layered process. And one of the layers is called SPAR. And it doesn't mean fighting with people. It means sense making leads to problem solving. When I sense make, I problem solve and come up with better decisions on situations. That leads to adaptability. I get better each time I use it. And guess what? If I do it more than once, it builds resilience. So let's go back to the sense make. That's the exact question you answered. How does this compare to the 911 call that I got for the fire yesterday and a week ago and a month ago? As I'm driving in, what am I seeing and feeling and smelling and tasting on the way that's exactly the same or that's different? When I'm standing on that threshold and I'm about to boot the door, what feels right or wrong about the situation that I'm in? I usually hear people yelling and screaming or see, you know, cars approaching, and those are missing. So those items are the baseline that creates the fidelity of every situation you've had in your life. And you're saying, well, can you equate that to something? Yeah. So City Market is right down the block here in Gunnison. And during COVID, there's certain things that I never thought that I wouldn't see on a shelf that were gone from that shelf. So in every single situation your firefighters are going into, there's danger and opportunity, and they need to see them before they leap. You got to look before you leap, and before you commit yourself to a situation, you got to do some mental gymnastics and say, how does this weigh in? And if it's different, if it's anomalous, or if there's incongruent signals, you got to take a knee, no matter how dangerous the situation is, because committing your resources may be a fatal act.
Yeah, and what he's talking about too is you're talking about before you're going anywhere and you're hanging around the firehouse, those training that you can do is sort of sharing those file folders and experiences. And I think it was someone that we were talking to, Greg, who told the stories, you know, they were on scene and whoever was controlling the scene because they were a firefighter, you know, they got up to the roof and then said, you know, he said something didn't feel right. And so he immediately called everyone off. Everyone get off the roof, everyone off now. And then sure enough, it collapsed after everyone got off from the fire. And he didn't really know what it was. But what that means is in that person's, you know, 20 years of experience, you gain so much tacit knowledge and you can begin to sense things sort of before they actually occur. And those are the perfect stories to share and explain to other people on the team. Like, hey, we went on this call. Typically, this is what happened, but this time I didn't notice it right away, but these were the indicators that I should have noticed leading up to this situation spiraling out of control or this situation getting worse, and I didn't notice them. Now, sharing those experiences are huge, and just building, we call them just file folder experiences, you know, doing that storytelling, explaining, hey, this is things I need to look out for. And then when you're talking about, like, you know, sort of tactical things to do in the moment, like I said, you know, human behavior and human performance are two sides of the same coin. So if I start to become overwhelmed, right, if I become get too many things thrown at me, I can't process my environment very well. That's why we spread load. That's why you have a team. That's why you have certain designated tasks and responsibilities, right? But I got to have someone kind of looking up and out overall, meaning we call it like our guardian angel process, where you have someone literally, hey, your job is to look at big picture and look up and out, because I'm so focused down and in on these specific tasks that I need to conduct, right, in order to save this you know, individual or building or situation, right, I'm not going to see big picture. But the problem is if everyone's looking down and in at that their own specific task, you're going to miss those pre-event indicators that are so prevalent. It just took someone to realize it. So we always do the, hey, I'm down and in, you're up and out, or I'm up and out, you're down and in. We build stuff like that into everything that we do. So if we're together anywhere, we're teaching a course, like Greg's up there explaining a concept, I make eye contact with him and I give him a signal that lets him know I'm going to the bathroom, right? No big deal. He continues on, right? But that knows to him, if it's been a few minutes and I'm not coming back, what's going on? So I can start that search party now versus waiting till the next day or an hour or 3 hours later. So things like that that you can build in, and same stuff, like we'll be going somewhere, we're looking for a place on the ground. I'm like, hey, Greg, I gotta look at my phone. So I'm literally so down and in my phone, but we're in this busy, you know, intersection. It's a major metropolitan city. Well, he's looking up and out, just make sure everything is going on. Those little simple things you can build in within your buddy teams, within your whole section to go, look, we have to have this overall picture. Who's on guardian angel today? Who's watching us? Who's specifically assigned to do that? Because we all say, oh, yeah, I'll cover you when you do this. But if I don't actually assign that role, those things start to slip through the cracks.
I think it's just to kind of summarize, we run four person crews, and usually the officer kind of runs that overwatch role. But in a situation that we had 2 weeks ago, we're splitting up parties into different rooms now. So now there is no longer this one person who's in the living room because we're all trying to, you know, spread everybody out. But now we don't have anyone kind of controlling everything. And who knows if someone walks through, you know, that front door. Now we got a new friend to deal with.
The stakes are higher now. The stakes are higher now than they've ever been because the situation sociologically has changed. Now that's going to ebb and flow and things will get better. But for right now, you understand that pandemonium, that turmoil, that anxiety that's going on right now and not being able to partner like you used to and not being able to see the other firefighters, that's going to lead to taking your eyes off the prize and somebody's going to get hurt. And it won't change for your unit or for another perhaps smaller fire agency until somebody get hurt. We know that. We know what happens is that somebody gets shot or killed or stabbed or broken in some manner, and then people step in and call it, Megan's Law, and here we are pushing money against it. We don't have to let it get that far. Sometimes we have to say, I need to back out of this situation now, even though I'm in the midst of a life-saving emergency, because it'll be the best course of action to save the most lives. Most likely course of action, this is going to happen, but whenever the facts, the artifacts and evidence lead me to believe that it's a dangerous situation, the math changes, the calculus changes.
So do you think with the current climate, do you think that there would be issues for firefighters that say, you know, I didn't necessarily sign up for this. I mean, we didn't sign up for this. I mean, but it changes. And every firefighter has the freedom of choice to leave the career if they don't like it that much, you know. But
yes, sir.
Is there a point that inaction or I'm not going to do that puts them in a higher liability position, you know?
Yeah, so I'll compare that. That's a perfect question. Craig's asking all the loaded questions today. You're asking all the detailed softballs that I can throw right.
I'm very
simple-minded for that.
So.
but I want you to think about it for just a second. It's like coppers with the duty to intervene. You see an out-of-control cop, you better step in and stop it, because if you don't, both of you are going to be going to jail at some point in the future, or at least censured, or you're going to lose your job and all these things are going to happen. So you got to be smarter than the average bear. That's called tactical cunning. You think first and foremost like a cunning adversary. You put your feet in their shoes and you walk around. So to answer the questions earlier about it, what do we do to prepare? I'd tabletop that. In my fire station, every single time that we got together for on-duty roll call, I'd say, you know, something like the old TV show, be careful out there. But then I'd add some teeth to it saying, in this situation, what would you do? Remember, you have the legal right to do this, but we hope you would do that. You got to set the standard for the personnel and then understand that it is in some instances a personal decision. If you think that the course of action that you're taking is going to result in your death or the death of another, then you have a duty to intervene. But you don't have to be a hero and go down with the ship dying. And I can preface that by, and my Marine buddies will hate me forever, but there was certain Marine interactions that I witnessed that were very different than Army interactions in kinetic combat. And one of the things was that the Marines were trained so readily to never leave a human being behind, never leave a person behind, that they would expose themselves to danger, IEDs, direct fire, and snipers, to recover somebody that was most certainly dead. And I know how hard that is. And there's an argument brewing. But the idea is, if I know you're most certainly dead and I can't do anything about that, and if I stay at ground zero, I'm going to be dead too. It's time to bail. Now, will you be sued? Of course you will. Will you be charged? Yes, and perhaps criminally. But the idea is that in the long game, the U.S. Supreme Court or your state Supreme Court will look in and go, this is ridiculous. You set an unreasonable standard, and they'll overrule it. Coppers that got in the trick bag, did bad things or looked the other way or didn't think through the situation before they acted. And anytime we put a round peg in a square hole, we're victims of that kind of thinking too. Firefighters, you have an additional taskers. For example, terrorism. Firefighters in the United States didn't have to worry about terrorism. Now you have to worry about domestic and international terrorism. So on the way to the scene, you see that ambulance, and no longer is it just an ambulance taking people out of the zone. Now it's the secondary device that was set in to attack first responders. So you got to talk about those things because they're going to happen. It's only a matter of time. And discussing them now is better than trying to figure them out in the heat of the moment.
So I think we as our culture tend to, when we latch onto something, we go all in on it. So mm-hmm. as someone who has experienced a bit of hypervigilance throughout my life, I think
right.
you can take everything that you're saying, and now every single call becomes stressful because, all right, is this, you know, like every time I see an ambulance, I'm not going to think, hey, am I in danger of this thing blowing up? I mean, I think that's a rough way to go into work every day. There has to be some sort of, and maybe it just is time. Maybe it's just time on the job, and you kind of get those cockles that'll start to raise when things aren't good because you have a baseline. But I think people just starting out in the career, can that be a problem that you're focusing on the wrong things?
I'm the architect of the Combat Hunter program, which was a Marine program before Marines went into combat. And the three things that were killing them, insider threats, snipers, and roadside bombs, IEDs of any manner.
What's an insider threat?
Insider threat is a person in a trusted position that's working for the other side. And then when you go into a house, they step in and shoot everybody in the house. Or they allow you to walk into an ambush because they know a lot of it's bad situation. So now you're facing these Marines, some of them well-trained veteran, some brand new, just off the yellow boot prints. And you got to prepare them to go into combat. And you want them confident and competent. And not everything's a bomb. And everything they're worried about is seeing their buddies blown up and coming back with one leg and one arm. And not everything's a sniper. But there's plenty of Marines that died from that direct fire from that sniper. So part of the process of training is training changes behaviors. So we train you so you can see life as it really is. You can see those dangers and opportunities, and you can navigate them. And by doing that, that not only reduces your stress level, it reduces the amount of crap that you have to look at on a call, because there's only a certain number of things that can kill you. And so you prioritize those mentally. And through rehearsal and through practical application and part-task training, you get better at it. And you know what happens? Your blood pressure lowers. And now you're able to get in there and do your job and not have to worry about these second and third order effects of the anxiety and stress of the situation. Now you don't look at that ambulance and go, holy crap, it's a bomb, because that ambulance needs certain things to be a bomb. This house needs certain things to be an ambush. And that bump on the road needs certain things to be an ID. So knowledge brings us out of that. Training, it changes that attitude.
And so to kind of help mitigate that, you know, you do realize that like the beauty of it is most things are what they seem. Most humans are good. Most people individually can be reasoned with. When we get into larger groups, we get dumb real fast.
Not too much.
But the idea is most things are exactly what they seem. And what everyone wants is like, okay, well, what are the indicators I need to look out for? You know, he write it down, or what can I list out? And it's like, hey, man, like that was the case, we'd be out of a job, and none of these things would happen. And it's not like that. But what you're really looking for is sort of incongruence in your environment. You know, something doesn't fit with this, right? Like it's a, you know, the words coming out of your mouth aren't matching up with what's manifesting on your body. I'm seeing some incongruence. There has to be a reason for that. But you've seen that in different situations. And you're talking about like, hey, how do I figure out what's going on ahead of the game? Well, yeah, you've got your training, you've got these discussions, you've got these tabletop exercises you can have, but en route, on the way to a call, that's when you're going, all right, what do we have? What do we know right now? What got reported? Okay, it's this, this, and this. This is what's coming from dispatch. And you all know sometimes we'll get reported, and then what you show up with on scene can be two completely different things. Okay, and then you already start automatically thinking about, all right, what do I like? What should I likely expect? What would that look like? What does a typical, you know, heart attack call look like? Everyone has a file folder for that. What does every vehicle fire look like? Because there's going to be similarities. And then once you have that baseline for those normal calls that you've already been on your past, you can literally sit there. Okay, well, if it's not that, what should I see? What should I expect? What is there any incongruence here? I'm getting a different story from the person when I show up versus what the call was. Is this the right person? Are they the person that made the call? You know what I'm saying? What did I miss here? Because I want that nice full picture. And that's the idea is once you start looking for, is there some incongruence here? Is there something odd or out of place other than from what I've typically seen 100 times before in the past? Then you can start to pull that thread. And Greg brought it up. And to your point, to how do I not become hypervigilant? You know, it's, you know, what's the most likely course of action? What's the most dangerous course of action? And out of all the indicators I'm seeing, which one is it leading toward? If it's you're seeing 9 of the 10 things you typically see on that call, well, it's probably going to be a typical call. But once you start going, well, hang on, I've never seen this before. And
you know, usually when we show up on scene, the reaction of the person is they're thankful, they're happy, they're this. This guy seems a little, there's something else going on here. Why don't we pause before we go rushing into that house, whether it's a, whatever the call is, and let's figure out and develop that kind of operational picture before we make a decision on action. And that stuff, you know, it sounds like that's a long process. It's really not. I'm literally talking about driving to the scene, having that conversation with people in the truck when you show up. Those little moments, that extra second, like Greg was talking about, that gift of time and distance allows you to evaluate the situation because you already know how to do your job effectively. So you can spring into action at any time and you're going to go right down your training is going to come out. It's going to take over and you know, you're going to respond well. So having that extra second, people have a lot more time in these situations than we think. And I know you're like, well, dude, we literally have lights and sirens on, we're running to a fire. Like I get it. Every second matters. But you know, so does every foot, meaning every foot that I have in distance from here to a situation is some time that I have to process it. And you can actually take that moment to make sure everything's fine and not overcommit.
So having a good baseline going into the 90% of calls and trying to take in as much normal information as you can, and then having pattern recognition of when something is not where it should be, and then disengaging, taking a step back and seeing what my most deadly threat is, and then the possibility of that happening. Is that kind of the flow chart?
Absolutely. So what Brian is telling you is talk about it on the way. I'm telling you, go back further to on-duty roll call training. We're also saying debrief the crap out of everything and turn it into a tabletop. Billy, what did you see? Julie, what did you see? Tommy, and we can turn those into learning experiences. Great thing about file folders. If I've got a fidelity-filled experience, I can turn it around and hand you what I learned from that experience, and your brain, because of the survival chemistry, will go, this is important. Listen. Open your ears. Listen. And then you add those to your training. You add them to rehearsal. You guys climb ladders and unroll hoses and roll up hoses and do all the physical stuff too. And I know you guys do it well, but some agencies aren't using the cognitive gym, and that's what they need to be doing. The most important 6 inches on any scene or homicide scene or crime scene or fire is between your ears. Slow time down. Think about it. What's in the best interest of everybody? And if it doesn't add up, because science is very particular in many instances, if it doesn't add up, you probably got a homicide, you probably got a suicide, you probably got an ambush. And that way you don't worry about them all day. You don't go to work every day saying somebody's trying to take me off the grid. Can you imagine going into a kinetic war zone every day and knowing you got three big things against you and you still have to fight the enemy? That's an untenable situation. So this allows you to calm down and be confident and be competent and come home at the end of your watch.
Here's something that I want to see your guys' opinion on, and you may not have the answer for this, but you know, one thing is 30, 40 years ago, a firefighter was fighting fires and that was pretty much it, right? Then we added medical services to it, and that actually is the majority of our job. You know, our department, not unlike any other, 75% of our calls to 80% are medical. So we're training to be firemen, right? That's probably the most dangerous thing that we may encounter, but it's less frequent, but we're putting a lot of hours in training that way. Then we need to train on medical, because now not only that can be a dangerous situation for us, but I mean, that's probably the most impactful thing we can do for the citizens, because we can save their lives, but there's a lot of liability incurred now. So now we've got that. Now we've got even more duties, and these that we're talking about today are the most dangerous.
Right.
So at what point do you, I mean, just are we
just
what
get point task do we saturated? Get,
yeah,
mean?
Are we, mm-hmm. You know, how can you keep up on all these things? And, you know, it's like a jack of all trades. And, you know, eventually with so many, you don't master them. And what we're talking about with you guys today, I mean, it might now be the most important thing just because
right.
of the threat. How do you find time for all this?
So that when it comes to stuff like this, whether it's the fire department or police, you know, agency, it's we don't do a good job of explaining what goes into the job and then what you can and cannot do. Because, as you know, same thing with police, like when someone dials 911, you answer, you go to the call. You can't just not do that. But, you know, when they put those additional responsibilities, it's like, you know, right now the federal government might be coming down with different types of guidelines or procedures for police work. This, well, they have to attach funding to that. If you're going to hold me to this standard, you have to train me to that standard. And sometimes that pushback with the city council or the alderman or mayor or whoever that is with the public there, no, okay, look, we're doing things now that are outside the purview of what we were trained to do. Now, we're going to continue to do that because we are 911. We're the last line of defense for everyone. But you have to understand that this is going to lead to some sort of catastrophic event. Something bad is going to happen, and you're going to try and make us liable for it. I'm telling you now that we are not capable. We don't have this capability, or we're not trained enough in this capability. So unless that changes, right, something is going to happen. So what we are doing is, especially you do that on the record, now something happens. Well, guess what? We told you right now. Now it's the city that's liable. It's not the person that shows up. And people get scared about having these conversations, and it should be the opposite way, because if you can articulate what it is that you do, how this is going to affect your job, you have a legal leg to stand on. I get, you know, I feel horrible that, like, police officer, fireman, or you're sitting here telling me, like, well, I'm not sure what legally could happen to me. It's like, no, look, if you're acting within your roles and responsibilities and how you were trained and within the law, then you don't have anything to worry about, right? If you're doing the right thing for the right reason, even if you can't articulate what the, you know, what the actual directive was that says that you can do that, as long as you were doing the right thing and following the law, then you're clear. And now if they want to try and come after you, you'll see what this stuff happens. And this is what Greg talks with, the sort of pendulum swing of logic, it seems, right? They'll go after some people, wait till the dust settles, wait another year or two. And then that stuff's going to get overturned. And then that person's going to get a big chunk of money that is coming out of all the taxpayers' dollars because they were, you know, fired illegally or the charges didn't hold up. I mean, this stuff gets settled that way, but you got to have people with the confidence and competence to know what they can and cannot do and make the best judgment based on that.
And let's go to your argument of presumed capability, Brian. You didn't say those words, but I'll give it there. Here, your firemen are going on calls on a freeway for a horrific traffic accident. And freeways are also used as high incident drug trafficking areas. So sooner or later, the vehicle and the fire you're putting out is going to be full of fentanyl, and there's going to be guns in the car and, you know, maybe a cartel member that's got warrants for him. What's your training on that? Are you training jointly with the state patrol? Do you have an internal policy on when you find that? Do you safeguard the evidence? You know, law enforcement back in the day and police work back in the day only had a certain amount of vehicles and a certain amount of people. And now we have to be the police on airplanes and at airports. And sooner or later, school shooters are going to take a shot at a fireman because you guys got big, bright, beautiful trucks and you're easily recognizable as that visible sign of authority. So those type of things complicate the situation. And they weren't present in Michigan when Andrew Keough attacked a school with a bomb in the early 1900s and set the precedent, you know. So what we don't do is we don't pay attention to precedent. We don't look at that and then go, you know, forward to the shooting in California with the first AK, you know, in a school and the person warned him. And then we don't fast forward that to, you know, the Columbine caper. We're supposed to learn from each one of those. And all we do is we use them as sort of case studies, and we never really truly learn by turning around to the people that run the community and saying, it's different now. We need more training. We need more experience.
I want to talk about training.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because that is, it seems like, oh, well, like a great example, we just got, there's a basically like a computer program that you can send out video training to everybody. They go on, they let it play while you're cooking dinner, and that's what happens.
Right.
And so, but now we are liable saying that, hey, you said you did this training. You know, we taught you how to pat down a person. And not all training is created equal. And now what I wanted to ask you guys is, there's a story I remember reading, and I'm sure you guys know it better than I do, but it basically goes along the lines of, there's a police officer who had an old school kind of revolver, and he would only shoot at the range. When he was done shooting, he would place the spent shell casings in his pocket. And when he actually got into a gunfight, instead of reloading his weapon, he put the empty shell casings in his pocket because that is what he trained to do. So can you speak to the difference between like a fixed and dynamic training style and how important that is?
what you're talking about, that, so that's a great example of what you do in training is what you'll do in the real event. So you have to go through everything, your procedures that you're going to do, because otherwise you're like that guy that, and I think he was killed and they found the empty shell casing in his pocket.
Right.
And so there's, you know, you're the big push been for a while. Finally, it's getting the blowback it deserves is this, everything's online. We're going to do video based this and that. That's okay for certain things, but I have to understand the difference between training and education. Hmm. So that, watching that video, going through that click-through series, whatever you have to do, that's education. Education is important, right? I mean, you get educated a lot, even in your own profession, on everything from resource management and how fire works and all of these different, but that doesn't, you can read all the books and watch all the videos, they ain't gonna help you put out a fire, right? You have to go do it. You have to get trained on the actual process. And what happens is, you know, they take things that should be done in a training program and it becomes education. Or you're going to watch this video, like you just said, now you know how to pat someone up. That's insane to me. Like the fact that like, this is a skill that I need to learn how to implement, not a piece of education that may enlighten.
Let me stop
like,
you real you can quick. Go, can I stop you real quick? Since yeah. we're on this topic, Craig brought it up. You're focusing on it right now. I really want to know, okay, the specific is, we're in charge of pat downs now, okay? Pat downs of people, all right? The cops decide that they're not going to show up or whatever. The video is an instructional video of how to do a pat down, and that's it.
I can't like
this. Falls hopelessly short.
Yeah, my skin is crawling right now just thinking about that. That's negligent on the part of whoever is making you conduct that process, conduct
it seems negligent,
and then but only allowing you this video to watch. That is absolutely ridiculous. Would they do that for law enforcement? Would can someone go through a police academy and watch that video and then go out on the road? That's absolutely insane. And you're getting set up for failure. That's something that how hard would it be to have someone from the local precinct, some officers come over during the day with your team and go, hey, this is how you properly conduct a pat down of someone. Here's some things I've noticed. Here's how you set up security. Like that's a skill that your life may depend on, and it's relegated to video-based training. That alone, I mean, that's well, on the part of whoever decided that was going to be. But what did Greg say earlier? Well, the insurance underwriters, the attorneys will say, yeah, good, check that box. We gave him training.
Hold on. First of all, anybody that wants the answer for the bullet in the pocket, the cops, that happened years ago, look up Charles Remsburg, The Tactical Edge. That's the lead story. Four California highway patrolmen were shot dead by a couple of people that trained more than they did. It's a horrific story, and you're touching around the edges. It's great. Second thing is, if you're a fireman and try to pat me down, I'm going to knock you on your ass, because there's no law that says that you have the right to pat me down. With police, there is. With police, they have reasonable suspicion and probable cause. They can conduct a pat-down search, Terry, stop, and frisk. There's a whole bunch of case law. What's the case law for firemen?
They left
and
that out,
I'm
Greg.
Not poking a finger in your eye. I'm just saying that if we don't have that, yes, you need to conduct a search for your own personal safety. And yes, there are offensive weapons. But what has the city council done? What has your local police done? What has your prosecutor done if the person resists you?
Well,
you know, and can you just walk out of the house?
Well, Greg, I'll tell you what. You know what wasn't on the training is, okay, you found a gun.
Now what do you do?
Now what do you do? Exactly.
Or like, hey.
Now you show them yours. Yeah. Hey, say we both got guns.
This bag of drugs that we found. Like,
right.
What do you want me to do with this?
You know why I'm making fun of it? I'm making fun of it.
Because it's ridiculous.
So I'll give you something you can use right now. Everybody listening, it's called the Kirkpatrick model. Kirkpatrick is the way that you can evaluate the training that you're doing. And it's based on four simple principles: reaction, learning, behavior, results. Reaction. What was the reaction of the fellow firefighters that took the training? And if it didn't pass the smell test, it's probably not cutting it. You get it? If everybody stood around and go, this is ridiculous, like we're talking about now, then it's probably shit. Pardon my language. Second thing is, what was the learning that occurred? Can you show me that the person now can conduct a pat down and find items? They found a ballpoint pen, and they found a knife, and they found one gun, but they missed three revolvers. Well, that shows learning didn't occur. Behavior. Did it change the behavior of your firemen in the moment? Did they come into the room and immediately cover each other and say, hey, listen, I have to pat you down for our own safety before I work on you. And if you say no, I'm leaving. So come on, submit. Whatever. You got to train in the talking too, not just the walking and the grabbing, right? And then if it didn't change the behavior, you got to broom it. And then finally, what are the results? What were the results today? What were the results this afternoon after the training? And what are the results out on the road? And if you can't meet those four criteria, with whatever training, you're paying too much. And it's okay to say to somebody, time out, this is wrong. I remember teaching out on the West Coast, and I had a brigade commander that came up to me, and his aide was a command sergeant major. And they said, hey, listen, we're not afraid to throw your ass off the stage if the stuff that you're spouting is just word salad and it don't work. And you know, I say it constantly when I'm teaching. Hey, if I don't teach you something new, push me down, roll me out of the classroom. You guys are, you know, free to not pay me and send me home. This is the semblance of training, and education is not training. You can't send somebody a pamphlet and put it on an email and say, now you're trained in patting people down and predicting danger. It just scares the hell out of me that you have to watch a video of patting down and doing it. And then, like you said, now what do we do? I found the gun. What's the next phase? That's wrong. Somebody's got to call bullshit or timeout, at least timeout.
So now, since I have you guys here, let's say we do, if you are patting someone, I like how you guys are our trainers now. So when you are patting someone down, you mentioned a ballpoint pen. Is that something are you just taking everything out of there? You find anything, you're taking it off of them.
Okay. So if you've ever seen somebody stabbed in the forehead with a ballpoint pen,
I have not.
Anything that can be turned into a street weapon, you want to make sure you distance from the person, because people become real damn resilient when you tell them no and start to turn everything into a street tool, right? So the idea is, I've got to understand why I'm conducting the pat down. If it's only for offensive weapons, stick to that. What if you find a 8-ball of cocaine? Do you mention that? Do you pass it by? So what we're saying is the standard that it's being created with the training isn't fidelity filled. So therefore it's up for speculation, and that never ends up okay. That, you know, why do you have referees at a baseball game? Why do you have umpires? Well, you know, you have people to call, that's bullshit, and this is okay. We're not doing that with the training they're giving you. I would say for your purposes right now, impact weapon, edge weapon, or guns, firearms of any kind are no-nos, and you got to say no up front. No is a complete sentence. You shouldn't be bullshitting around with people. If I say no and I'm here running the scene, you got to adhere to my principles or you got to leave.
I'm just curious as to what is the situation that they think you'll be in where you're required or need to conduct a pat down. What's the purpose of having you guys do that?
Yeah, it's my understanding that they do not want to go hands-on and physically touch someone because that is seen as assault. So if they are with us, we are have either implied consent or they give us consent to go hands on with them, to give them a medical eval that we right. would conduct the search because they should not be. Is that kind of how you understand that?
I would say that, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, I don't want to sound like we don't know what the hell's going on, but you know, it's
because, I mean, that's the idea, is if you're going to evaluate someone, you feel the need. I mean, putting myself in your shoes, I would put it on that person. And you just have to be like, look, this is about my safety. I don't care what you have. I'm here to do this job. I don't care if you've got fentanyl in your pocket or a gun. I need to know about it, and I need to get it away from me so I can do my job. I mean, I would always put it as that, because this sounds like something that could spiral out of control, where you're going to help someone and then you're searching them, and then they're like, oh, wait a minute, damn, I got that 8-ball of blow in my pocket, and I got I'm a prior convicted felon, and now it turns into a fight or a situation, yeah. Or their friends that knows it. Now it's like, where is this actually going?
So, I mean, I think where we see this the most is our transient population, is because we have such a large population in our city that we consistently run on, that, you know, they have 8 layers of clothing on, and you know, we need to, the cops aren't going to come because it's just a medical call, and yep. It gives us the ability to search their person for something that's going to hurt us. And to be honest with you, in my experience, we run on them so much, they kind of know the deal. But now there are these tent cities where you're not just dealing with one homeless person. And if that person gave this dude something to hold, and now we're coming up there, like, we're pretty good about being like, hey man, we're not the cops. We don't care. We just don't want to get hurt. I think that's where it happens.
By the same token, so go back, implied consent, if I'm hearing it right, implied consent means the person's out of it so much that they couldn't say yes, even if they had all the information. So you're going to run into those situations, and the law will generally come in and say, that's absolutely fine. But what you just said, and I know you didn't mean it the way that you said it, but unintentionally, we were working in combat zones where the last unit in didn't want to take any more casualties and said, look, we don't care what you do. We'll stay on our side. You'll stay on your side. That's not making it any better for the copper that has to come in after you. And I know that you have different roles, but it has to be an organized, coordinated 360-degree strategy. And it has to go all the way to the city as well. Because if you tell the city, listen, we're not going on these calls anymore because of this, then they're going to say, well, we'll fire you and get somebody that does. Yeah, no, that's not how this works. It's called a class action lawsuit. You can't continue to run the way that you're doing until there's an emergency and then change the rules. Brian has a great thing that he tells people when we're talking to clients about all rules are written in blood. And what that means is that you have to die before somebody steps in and takes an active role in those situations. When you go in that tent city, everything's fine till it's not. Everything's fine till one person comes out with the bat and they have a, you know, an emotionally disturbed person with a mental problem. And then everybody chips in and now you got a firefighter hostage or you got a homicide. You can't wait till those things happen. You got to tabletop them now, and you're not in an advantageous position because the law doesn't favor you because this is new. And when things are new, that's when the biggest mistakes happen. So you just got to let clear heads prevail, and you got to call a town hall meeting, and you got to say, here's our five grievances. We love being firefighters. We love being paramedics. We love working for this city, but it's not going to get easier. How are we going to address these together? Now you enlist the aid of your city council, your mayor, your prosecutor, and, you know, the cops and everybody, and you have a concerted effort. Because if you don't, you know, you're going to have a situation like that in Ferguson, which is just not about fire and it's just not about police. And now it's up to $6 billion in reparations. It doesn't need to get that far. If it's just lip service, it'll never change until one of your firefighters is killed. And we can prevent that right now.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like when one department takes the first step to make this a priority, the rest will fall like dominoes.
Yes.
Have you noticed something going out and working with either smaller fire departments or larger fire departments that's like a common thread that you might think would be like, hey, if let's knock this big item down first?
No, and you'd be surprised, you know, sometimes the larger the department or agency, the harder it is to get things done, right? I mean, it's the more bureaucracy, there's more this. And then some of those like smaller to medium-sized ones, yeah, they might not have the funding, but they can usually get things through, right? They can get things accomplished because it requires so much of teamwork, of a regional approach. I mean, even where you're at, you have neighboring jurisdictions and you have all these different folks that you have to link up with. And well, that falls under this. And well, technically that falls under federal funding. So if we just get a bunch of folks together in the region, we can get it paid for by Uncle Sam. I mean, there's different ways to do that stuff, but the best units that I've ever had the, you know, been fortunate enough to work with, whether that was military, law enforcement, a private company. I mean, I'm talking just the actual teams, like they're the ones that they put in the time to train and rehearse, and they do it with very limited budget. Sometimes they just make it part of the culture. Like every morning is everyone knows you got to come in with a few questions and a few things to go over. Cause we're going to have a little, tabletop exercise that we're going to do. Everyone knows that at this time, it's the last, you know, half hour of the shift. This is when we all come in and we sit down and do the debrief, and the leader starts out going, hey, here's how I screwed up today, right? Once you start building those things in, it becomes that culture of everyone talking, everyone communicating, and you start to identify a lot of these issues. So I would say, you know, sometimes it's easier at a smaller agency to do stuff, you know, because you don't have that bureaucracy, but sometimes the larger ones, they then also have like a bigger budget so they can do stuff. It just depends. But the best, highest functioning teams, it's not about some cool school or some cool course that you go to. It's just day in, day out, running rehearsals and running reps. And that's what builds really good teams.
I think that's a perfect place to end it up. How do people find out about you? How can people get a hold and get you guys out to their department?
So we've got our company's called Arcadia Cognarati. So you can kind of look up Arcadia Cognarati and check us out. We're on social media or go to our website, and you can always reach out to me. I'm Brian@ArcadiaCognarati.com. And then we of course have our podcast as well, the Left of Greg podcast, where we talk about different topics, something that's in the news or something that we kind of want to discuss as it relates to human performance and human behavior. And when I say human performance, I mean sort of cognitive performance. You know, we take different situations that may have occurred, and we sort of peel back the layers of the onion using the way the methods that we do kind of when we're in class and we're training folks. So it's just a way of, this is how we look at it. This is what this means. This is how I can identify these things before they occur. And this is how I mitigate it. And, you know, so it's kind of like one of those, it's not for everyone, but some people find an episode and they'll just be like, wow, I really love this. This really spoke to me. But, you know, if they can reach out to us there, or at the website and anytime, and we're always willing to give more, do more. And we try to do a lot of stuff for free. Sometimes we try to give away as much as we possibly can. That's part of it in the podcast. Like, hey, we'll just talk about something that we would actually talk about in class. Obviously it's different. It's over a podcast. It's not a training in a training course, but you know, we do that and we do different types of webinars. And like Greg said, we've done stuff in his backyard, my backyard. I tried to before, but same thing. Some people are like, well, you know, we'll see. I'm like, I literally live across the street.
It's easy to say no. Yeah, it's so much easier for people to say no. Well, thank you guys both so much. Really appreciate it. We'll put all the links to get a hold of you guys in the description here. So thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
We appreciate
you. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Thanks, guys.